Wait a minute, I know where this is.
You do, Mum?
Yes, it's Kastav in Croatia, just outside Rijeka.
Oh, so it is. I'd planned to take us somewhere else. I must have taken a wrong turn at the 13th century.
Well, it's an easy mistake to make. The church dates from the 13th century, if memory serves. Are you all right, Latimer? You look unwell.
I find it rather unsettling that you know more about our location than I do, Mum. Perhaps this is the beginning of the apocalypse.
Well, in that case, I'll have an extra cup of tea just to be on the safe side.
Very good, Mum.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't developed a crush on any nefarious Starfleet captains. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Welcome to the beautiful village of Kastav. It's very close to Rijeka, and I was here just a few weeks ago for Recon, a fantastic Croatian convention. The last time I came here was with the wonderful Igor and Tamara, who looked after us during our stay. It really is the most beautiful village, with narrow cobbled streets and medieval buildings and an extraordinary number of cats. What makes it even more atmospheric is knowing about the last witch burning in Europe that took place here in the 1700s. But this little grassy dell where the trial took place doesn't feel haunted. At least...
I'm sorry to disturb you, but your guest has arrived. A Miss Lucy Hounson.
Splendid. Let's see her calling card.
I'm afraid she didn't have a calling card.
Oh, how odd.
Indeed. I was about to send her away when she gave me this phial of water. I've taken the liberty of testing it, Mum, and can confirm that it was drawn from Xanadu's Sunless Sea.
Oh, there's a label. It says, "This belongs to the Sylvan historian, purveyor of stories, established 1986. Whomsoever possesses me has her trust." I think I should keep hold of this, Latimer.
Really, Mum? I know several individuals who would pay rather handsomely for this.
Like I said, I think I should keep hold of this, Latimer. Now send her over.
Very good, Mum.
For those of you who don't know, Lucy is the writer of the Worldmaker trilogy, published by Tor UK, the first novel of which is called Starborn. She also hosts the Breaking the Glass Slipper podcast.
Miss Lucy Hounson, Mum.
Hello, Lucy. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Isn't it the most beautiful place?
It's beautiful and somewhat eerie as well.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons I fell in love with the place. Because it's such a beautiful village. And also, oh, here's where the last witch burning in Europe happened. Interestingly, it was male and female witches that were burned. And I found that really fascinating.
Well, at least they were into gender equality.
They very much were. I think it might have been 6 men and 7 women. I can't remember the exact numbers. I'll have to ask my host when I see him again what the exact numbers were. But yes, I was quite surprised. We were speculating the first time we came here that perhaps they were all just ungodly and didn't fit in with religion's control at the time.
I think that is a very distinct possibility.
Yeah. Would you care for some tea?
You know how much I love tea. I am a tea drinker through and through. I mean, coffee is wonderful, but, you know, there are so many different varieties of tea.
Yes. Which would you prefer to have today? We have a selection.
Well, if you have Earl Grey, then I'm partial to the Earl.
I do have Earl Grey. And would you like it by itself or with a little bit of lemon? How do you take it?
Oh, absolutely unadulterated, just
Marvelous.
On its own.
That's how I have my Earl Grey.
Oh, excellent. I found a fellow Earl Grey purist.
Yes, it's you, me and Captain Picard. So, you know, we're going to be fine. I'll pour. And I was wondering if you would like a slice of baklava.
Oh, that would fit in perfectly with where we are.
Yes.
It's very sweet as well, so I'll only take a little bit.
Yes, it's something you don't need to eat a lot of to get the full enjoyment, but it's from a cafe down in Rijeka, which is excellent. So I will cut you a slice here. I hope you don't mind the chickens over there in their pen. They won't bother you. You're not allergic to chickens, are you?
Oh, no, not at all. I was going to ask you if they were the pantaloon variety.
The pantaloon variety? I don't know. I was about to ask the chickens if they are, but of course... They can sing, but they can't talk, so they can't tell me. Tell me more about pantaloon variety chickens.
Well, I live in Devon, and there's a lovely mill nearby called Otterton Mill, which is a bakery and also a cafe. And I'm not sure, I've not been there for a few months, so I don't know if the chickens are still there, but they have chickens. And my sister is very fond of the ones with these big, fluffy pantaloons. Well, she calls them pantaloons because they look very much like big baggy pantaloons, but they're really quite sweet, and they have there's black ones and there's also golden ones, and they look Ooh. Very fine indeed.
Oh, well, as you can see, our chickens do have some very fine feathers, and yes, I suppose they could look a little bit like pantaloons. But I don't even know what breed they are, to be honest. We tried to compare them to various pictures, but they didn't quite fit any of them.
They're unique.
So in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
Well, this is very interesting, considering the history of witchcraft, you know, in the village we currently sit in. But I've brought a little porcelain box with me, which I have had since I was about 15 years old. And it has a rather magnificent shoe on the top of it.
Oh, yes.
And I love me a good boot. So when I was 15, I was a bit into witchcraft, and I was also very influenced by Harry Potter. So I made a wand, which Aww. I put one of my own golden hairs into.
As you do.
And, yeah, as one does. And this little box, I filled it with odd treasures that I found around the garden. And I had a look at it this morning, and there are two white feathers. There's a sycamore pod, a butterfly pin, and a rather odd shard of mirror, which I can only guess where that came from. And it looks a bit like a kind of witch's reagents. And obviously, I was going to use these in some kind of spell. But over the intervening years, I can't remember what it was going to be about. Hopefully, it wasn't too evil a curse. They look quite nice objects. No creepy raven's claws or bat wings. So I don't know. You can have a look at them. I've got them right here. Any ideas?
I'm not sure. There does seem to be a common theme of flight, perhaps, especially with a sycamore pod, the way that they can kind of float in the air more easily, and the feathers. Not sure about the mirror, though. But, you know, this sounds like the beginning of some kind of story where you find a thing that you forgot about and it has all of the ingredients you need to save the world. So I think you should hang on to it.
I think I should too. And, I mean, I have been hanging on to it for about 16 years and it's survived. It's survived a house move. It's probably survived a change of dressing table. And it's there's nothing securing the lid on the top of the box because it's just porcelain and it's just the lid lifts right off. So I'm amazed that the all of those little trinkets are still alive and well in there. But I don't think I'll ever part with them. They're just special.
Yes, yes. No, never part with them. It's like one of those things, isn't it? Like, I'm one of these people that doesn't like to throw things away because they might come in useful. And you can just imagine it, can't you, that there is some kind of like magical apocalypse. If you had thrown those things out, it would happen like the week after you threw them out. And you'd be
absolutely
like, damn, why did I throw that? Because that always happens to me. Anytime I have a big clear out and I feel very virtuous, a week later, I need one of the things that I held on to for 10 years and I haven't got it anymore.
It's always the way. I try not to be a bit of a klepto, but sometimes, you know, I find rocks that I've picked up off the beach and, you know, kind of secreted in drawers or behind bookshelves. And I'm like, really should probably get rid of these, but they're not doing any harm. Why not keep them?
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, you're a fan of Dragon Age. I was wondering what it is about those games that you love.
Now, this is really funny because last night I was editing an episode of our podcast called Breaking the Glass Slipper, and I was talking about Dragon Age with our guest. And that's most of the conversation is about what makes Dragon Age an amazing game. And I agree with our guest, Emily. It's the narrative, and it's so story rich, and it has a really fantastic tapestry of history behind it. And I love the way that each new game builds on the game that's gone before. Mm-hmm. It's also the companions. It places a really strong emphasis on forging bonds and relationships, and not just romantic relationships, but bonds of friendship too. That's so immersive, and you can lose hours of your life to it.
Yes, I've only played Inquisition, and I did lose some hours, shall we say, to that game.
If you play it on PC through Origin, it helpfully keeps account of exactly how many hours of your life that you've lost to this particular game. I don't really want to be reminded that I've played 700 hours of Dragon Age.
Good Lord, no. Wow, that's impressive.
Let's not talk about Skyrim and the 1,000 hours I might have played on that.
Ah, oh, Skyrim. I am so fond of Skyrim. It's, yes. So, obviously, there are romantic elements to this. When I was playing Inquisition, I was trying for ages to romance Cassandra, and I was really upset when I realised I couldn't. So I plumped for Cullen. In the end,
we've all plumped for Cullen.
You know, he was, you know, obviously second best to Cassandra. But I have remembered her name correctly, haven't I? Because this was like 2 years ago or so that I played this. One of the things that really freaked me out when I was playing it was that there was a particular cutscene where he smiled, and I actually felt this flicker of, oh, that's such a lovely smile. And I thought, wait, this is a computer game, and I've never had that experience with a computer game before. How have you experienced the romantic sides of the games?
I completely agree. It's like amazing that you can get that flutter in your belly just from playing a computer game. But that's the beauty of first person and role-playing video games, because you're, for those hours that you're playing, you really aren't you anymore. You're really that character. And I find Dragon Age takes building relationships very seriously. I am a huge fan of Dragon Age 2. I think that it's not as well built as the previous game and Inquisition, but its companions are probably my favourite companions of any Dragon Age game. And every single playthrough, I always end up with Anders, because I know he's a bit of a terrorist, and but we shouldn't hold that against him, because he's also a freedom fighter, and he's also very upset about the mages being oppressed. And I am a bit naughty. I do sleep with everybody. There is a way to do that.
Well, if you can, why not?
I equal opportunities and yeah. All that. but at the end of the day, I always end up with Anders. And there's this amazing scene in Act 2 where he just kisses you really, like, out of the blue. And I was like, oh! I had to replay that scene about 10 times because I was so excited.
I found that really, it was, what was a shock to me, because I'm a lifelong, pretty much, tabletop and LARPer, and I didn't think that you'd be able to experience anything which even approached that flutter you get in your chest if you're role-playing and there's a romance involved. But to get it from a computer game really shocked me, so I'm glad I'm not the only one. This is quite reassuring to me.
I'm sure that neither of us are the only ones. If you look at my Pinterest board of Dragon Age, there's a really funny cartoon where it's the relationship with Cullen, and the player is just like slumped over her keyboard in a kind of rapture, and Cullen on the screen is going, "Inquisitor, Inquisitor, why aren't you saying anything?"
Oh dear. Yeah, we're lost, aren't we?
There's no hope left.
So you're also a cosplayer, and I love cosplay so much. I was wondering if there's a costume that you aspire to make that you haven't made yet. Is there something that you're kind of, that you consider your peak thing that you're aiming for?
Okay, let's preface this by saying my skills are a novice's compared to yours. All hail your amazing cosplaying skills, because I have to have quite a lot of help with my costumes. Really good question. There's so much I want to do. I would really quite like to do Kira from The Dark Crystal because she has wings.
Oh yes,
but they're hidden most of the time under her cloak, and I love that scene where they jump off the cliff and her wings snap out and they glide down, and he says, oh well, I don't have wings, and she's like, of course not, you're a boy. Best put down ever.
I love that so much. It's a lovely costume as well.
It's a lovely costume, and it's all like leafy, and there's like the natural world, and she has this really lovely hood, and but it would be a challenge to get the wings to not just be wings that hang, that they could actually snap open as well.
Yeah, it would be. I know somebody who's made wings like that, I'm sure of it. Not that particular design, they were kind of heavier and they were for a demonic costume for a LARP, but they actually could, you know, collapse them and extend them again, and they were very cool. So yeah, it is possible, but totally beyond my skills as well. I think that would need a lot of work, wouldn't it?
It would need a lot of work, but I've always wanted to cosplay a character with wings, because this my secret desire is to fly.
Ah, see, that's why you gathered those things in your little porcelain box.
Oh, see, there, the feathers. All making sense.
Yeah, there's something going on there. I'd hang on to that, definitely.
Oh, one day.
Now, the first time that we were in Croatia, we met we met so many marvellous people, but one of the people who hosted us is an incredible woman called Tamara, and she's a social anthropologist, and she wrote her thesis on cosplay. And she was exploring in her thesis the idea that cosplay has a similar psychological effect to wearing masks. And she used examples like carnival and things like that, where it's a liberating experience and that you can feel psychologically freer to behave differently than in your everyday life. And I was wondering if there was anything in that for you, if that resonates with you, if you feel different when you cosplay.
I think that's a really interesting topic, and I think it's true for a lot of people. I'm not so good at the acting and element part of cosplay. I've never really done it kind of properly. I think the closest I've ever got to that is in our D&D, when you really are the character, but of course you're not dressed up. It's all part of the storytelling. But yeah, I mean, from that perspective, I have two D&D characters, and they're both very different. But yeah, it is really freeing, because you do, for 3 hours, you just put aside, you know, everything that's happened that day, and you're really into the current peril or the adventure. And it's really good fun, actually, having your two characters and kind of flipping between the two and realizing that they're very different personality wise and also being able to interact with the other people around the table and build relationships with them. We don't have any romantic relationships, so I don't think we know each other that well, but it's really, we've been doing it for a year now, and we've been on a lot of adventures together, and we've really built this incredible history of everything we've done, and it's so real. It's as real to me as the books that I write, and I think that's incredibly rewarding.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was one of these things that sometimes it occurs to me that I've lived all of these lives having role played for so many years, and that I have memories like I have memories of my real life. And it, you know, when you have enough distance in terms of time and location, they almost take on similar qualities, which is kind of insane.
I know, it's amazing, but it's what that quote about, you know, that reading, when a reader lives 1,000 lives.
And
being,
I think,
inside stories.
Yeah, I agree. I've only ever what I would call cosplay in terms of replicating an actual costume of an actual character. I've only done that once, and I was one of the tavern wenches from Skyrim. And I made like a little sign which looked like the menu where you can select what you want, like if you want to learn more information or if you want to buy food or whatever. And one of the things that was really interesting about the experience of cosplaying for me was that it was in a huge room. It was at a sci-fi weekender many years ago, and it was in a huge room with loads of other people that were cosplaying, and there was such an incredible atmosphere of kind of mutual joy at looking at each other's costumes and being excited by the craftsmanship and the kind of the shared hobby. Is that something that you've experienced as well?
Yes, very much. Particularly at Nine Worlds Convention, because the other conventions aren't quite so hot on cosplay. But it's really exciting to walk around and see what other people have come up with. And the very first cosplay that I did was, of course, Daenerys. and it was that famous blue chiffon dress that she wears quite early on. And there was a couple of other women with the same idea. But instead of feeling, you know, like when you turn up at a party and it's that old stereotype, someone's wearing the same dress and you're like, oh, yeah. God, this is embarrassing. But instead of being embarrassing, it was just cool because we all got together and had a group photo.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
It was great. And one of the things that was funny was because my character wasn't like a prominent character, it's like a background character. So there were very few people who actually recognised what I was cosplaying as. But then when people did, the rush, and there were these, I'll never forget these two blokes, one of whom was dressed as Jon Snow, I think, ran up to me and went, Skyrim lady! And we were just like going, yay, because we all love the game so much. And it was a really bizarre but really magical experience. So
I would have loved to see Skyrim lady.
I still have it somewhere. I don't. It's scattered all over my little caches of LARP costume and stuff. But I don't have time to cosplay now because I like to make my kind of fabric armor for going out to be an author and wear my kind of dressing up clothes for that. That takes up all my time in terms of dressmaking. But
you do have some magnificent coats.
Yes. Yes. They have a +5 armor bonus when in public. They are very, very useful. they're a good thing to hide behind, shall we say.
+5 to charisma.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go as far as to say that. but I don't know. I'm trying to think. Definitely not dex. I think some of them might have minuses to dex, actually, because they can be quite unwieldy in some circumstances. Now, you have experience as a bookseller in Waterstones. I was wondering if you've learned anything from that job which has helped you in your career as an author.
Well, I did. A while ago, I wrote a few articles on the relationship between writing and bookselling. And I think very much so. I think it's been really beneficial overall just to be, well, firstly, to be in an environment where you're surrounded by stories and by stories in their finished form. And you kind of get a much clearer idea how books are presented and how they're marketed and how they're displayed on shelves. But I think it goes deeper than that because you kind of feel like you're absorbing it through some kind of osmosis, like this idea that this is something you can do too. And I think when you're starting out as an unpublished author who's desperate to be a published author, it's a lonely time. And sometimes being in a bookshop can make you feel worse because you think, well, look at all these people who have already done something that I really, really want to do. Yes. But at the same time, it's also very inspiring because you can see that, you know, it is possible. And there are people around you, fellow booksellers, who are clearly very passionate about your pursuit and what you really like to do. And then there are practical things like reviewing and writing review cards and any kind of non-fiction writing. It really, really helps hone your fiction writing. So I think it's a really good place to kind of learn about the industry of writing, which is something that you can't really experience alone in your bedroom when you're just you and the Microsoft Word document. You get a very unique overview of the end process and the, obviously as an author, the organic beginning process. And it's just the bit in the middle that's a mystery.
Yeah. Does it give you a very accurate sense of discoverability and the challenge of discoverability being in a shop with thousands of books?
It does, yeah. It can get a bit dark, I think, when you look around you and you think, wow, there's a lot of stuff here, and you suddenly realise how important cover design is, for example. Mm. You know, it's a bit like a peacock, like you just walk through a shop and see what catches your eye. So obviously a cover is really important, but also merchandising and learning where your book will sit in the market is so important. Mm. Because if you can approach an agent with that information, it looks a lot more professional and it looks like you're thinking and you've had a deep consideration of how it's going to be sold, because while we all like to pretend that writing is an ephemeral and magical process, it's also a business, and there's a lot of the kind of nitty-gritty financial stuff which we don't really like to think about, that's plays an enormous part of an author's life. So I think knowing all of that kind of before you start out is very valuable.
Yeah, I would really agree with that, because I am rubbish at understanding where my work fits into the market, because as individuals we read chaotically and we read all sorts of things without necessarily an appreciation of where they fit into the market. So if someone says to me, so, you know, what are your books like, or could you express your book in this plus this or this meets this, and I'm just like, no, I'm rubbish at it. So I think being able to understand that is a definite advantage.
I think that this meets this is always difficult. I don't personally have one of those, really, unless it's David Eddings meets Trudy Canavan, which doesn't really tell you very much about the book at all.
Yeah, it's one of those tricky things, isn't it, where how you can breach that gap as a person who has created a world, being able to describe it to somebody who hasn't encountered your world yet. And I find that gulf so difficult to cross. Really, really tough. Mm-hmm. So if you could fire a fictional villain into the sun, which one would it be and why?
Oh, right, because they're a bad villain or because they're a really good villain and you hate them?
Wanting to do it because you hate them so much is totally valid.
Okay, so you have to forgive me because it has been probably about 15 years since I read this trilogy, but he's stayed with me because I hated him so much. It's Regal from the Farseer trilogy by Robin Hobb.
Ah, I'm only in the first book of that trilogy, and I think I'm about halfway through the book, and already I am forming a very negative opinion of this person. Yes.
I hated him with an intense passion. It's because Fitz is such a great character and he's so sympathetic. And Regal is a massive bastard. He has no redeeming features whatsoever. And he's someone you absolutely love to hate. But that almost makes it comic. There's nothing funny about him. He's just horrible. And you feel physical pain whenever he gets what he wants or he causes harm to, you know, your beloved character. So I think he, out of everybody, he totally deserves to burn. I mean, like, he's worse than Sauron.
Excellent. I love that. You're worse than Sauron. That is... Yeah. That's a good insult.
Who wanted to cover all the lands with darkness?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as good people go, Sauron is not. So... Now, whenever I have a friend come to take tea with me in the tea lair, I like to ask on the Twitters whether anyone has any questions that they would like to ask if they were able to be here with us. And we've actually already covered one of them. Marguerite Kenner wanted to ask about your Dragon Age romances, which I already planned to ask you already. So I'm going to ask you a question on behalf of Matt Dillon, who would like to know how appropriate it is to have a crush on the outsider.
Well, clearly it's very appropriate.
So perhaps in case listeners are thinking, who's the outsider? Could you give us some context for this?
Okay, so anyone who's played Dishonored or Dishonored 2 will know who the outsider is. He is basically the deity of the world. He's not considered a deity by a lot of people. There's the kind of main religious movement, which is led by the overseers, and they spend their lives basically saying that the outsider is a heretic and anyone who follows him has to be purged, which just makes him more attractive, you know. Everyone loves a good heretic. He's got a really fascinating history. He has the appearance of a kind of teenage boy who was 4,000 years ago was sacrificed in a kind of prophecy by a whole load of mysterious priests, because they said that a particular boy on a particular day, if they sacrificed him, he would become one with the void, which is pretty cool. Anyway, that's what happened. He became one with the void. And the void is this odd place, which is kind of like you could go there when you dream, but otherwise it's a bit like the Fade, I suppose, from Dragon Age. But yeah, it's a bit darker because Dishonored is a pretty grim world. It's very steampunk. It's very cool. But The Outsider is just hugely compelling. And you encounter him quite a lot in both games. But yeah, I just have this thing for him because I love odd, dark characters who you don't really know if he's good or bad. He's kind of neither. He just observes. He observes humanity and comments on their deeds.
You know, I think I played Dishonored years ago and I have no recollection of this whatsoever. I have a lot of recollections of dragging bodies into places where they wouldn't be found. Maybe I'm just mixing that up with another game. I'm not sure.
Well, Dishonored has a lot of bodies that need to be dragged into places they can't be found.
Yeah, I'm kind of slightly disturbed that that is what is stuck in my mind rather than the really hot Outsider, which I'm sad about now. I may have to go and revisit that.
You really, really need to. It's really good. And there's a lot of amazing fan fiction, which I fell into the fan fiction hole and didn't climb out again for about 3 hours.
Marvellous. So I would like to ask you a question so that we can enjoy the talents of those chickens over there. I would like to know what you would choose as the theme tune of your life so that we could ask the chickens to sing it for us.
Okay, this won't come as a surprise to anybody, but the Skyrim main theme called Dragonborn.
Ah, that's such an awesome piece of music.
Yes. It's composed by Jeremy Sewell, and he also did the theme tune for Morrowind, which I absolutely love as well. Skyrim, though, it's just so dramatic, and there are like chanting monk warriors at the beginning, and it's just like the most amazing thing ever. So, yeah, epic.
Yes, yes. Okay then, little chickens. Please could you sing Dragonborn, written by Jeremy Sewell, which is the main theme for Skyrim for Lucy, please. And there they go.
Oh my gosh. It's a beautiful rendition. It's bringing a tear to my eye.
I think it sounds perhaps slightly less heroic and epic, but no offence, chicken.
But no, it's still lovely. Don't be offended.
It's like just bringing out another side to that piece of music, shall we say.
It's multifaceted.
Yes, yes, yes. That's a very, very good way of putting it. Now, am I right in thinking that the final novel in your Worldmaker trilogy is coming out in December?
That's right, it is. It's called Firestorm, and which is a suitably epic title. I had to find one that fitted with Starborn and Heartland. You can see a pattern emerging here. And yeah, that'll complete the trilogy. So there's a lot of stuff in it. There's time travel, there's assassins, there's like tons of magic, there's battles, a crumbling empire, freedom fighters, dragons, obviously. Can't have a good fantasy without dragons. So there's lots to look forward to.
Fantastic. And what are you planning next? Are you going to stay within fantasy or are you going to branch out into other genres?
I'm doing a bit of branching out, actually. I've got a project that I've just started research on, which will be a historical folktale set in Devon, very locally, actually. I'm going to set it in the Dark Ages, so about 500 AD after the Romans left. Ooh. And everything started sliding backwards into darkness. But it's a great, really great period because we don't know very much about it, and the sources that we do have are very conflicting. So I thought it was a perfect setting for a folk tale, which often has lots of unexplained magic in, but nobody ever asks how that magic is done because it's a folk tale. So I'm really looking forward to creating, you know, reimagining this particular era, which will be a new experience for me because I spend most of my time in a secondary world making everything up as I go along.
So with the World Maker trilogy, would you call that secondary world fantasy or epic fantasy or heroic? Yeah. Where would you put it? Oh, so all of them.
All of those things, pretty much, yeah. It's kind of a lighter epic fantasy. It's not grimdark, but it's not very comic either. It's kind of just got a light feel to it in a kind of Trudy Canavan-esque way.
Mm-hmm. This one you're working on at the moment, would that be historical fantasy or are you not going to have... it as fantasy at all?
It's going to hopefully occupy a cross-genre spot. I don't think I can ever write anything that is not fantasy. But I wanted to move away from pure secondary world epic fantasy because I think that it would challenge me to do something a little bit different. And the minute I heard this particular folktale many years ago, I thought it was a great story that possibly hasn't been explored. You know, it's very famous, but there's certain elements of it that I think could be retold and re-examined. And I wanted to pick an interesting historical time to set that in. And because I'm lucky enough to live in Devon, which is really beautiful, there are some Neolithic and also post-Roman remains up on a hill that's only about 2 miles from my house. So I'm going to set it up there, which is really cool. So it'll have a local history angle to it as well.
That's brilliant. And you don't have to go far for research.
No, I've already been up there and had a poke around.
Excellent. That sounds really cool. Now, let me just check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Oh, my God. Did we drink all that tea?
We did drink all of this tea. Yes, that is the end of the Earl Grey, I'm afraid. So all that leaves for me to say is thank you so much for coming all the way to Croatia to take tea with me today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And I must say, I, you know, think this village is beautiful and would totally like to come back again someday.
Yes, I think that we're probably going to be quite regular visitors to this region. So if you do have time, go down into Rijeka because it's absolutely beautiful. Latimer will show you the way out of this little grassy, almost like an amphitheatre, isn't it? This little grassy area that we're in now. And
it is rather.
Yeah, and we'll direct you back to the best way for you to get out of the village. And I will hopefully see you at a convention at some point in the next year or so.
I'm sure you will. And I expect another magnificent coat.
I'm working on it. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
This way, Mum.
Oh, look, the cats have come to say goodbye to Lucy. All of them, by the look of it.
I think they mean to say goodbye in the final sense of the word, Mum.
Don't be horrible, Latimer. I mean, yes, it may look like they're blocking her exit. And yes, they've now surrounded her. And yes, they're all staring at her with obvious intent. But that doesn't mean to say they want to kill her.
I've always admired your optimism, Mum.
I think Lucy shares it. She doesn't look concerned, rather...
resigned to her fate. One doesn't lay down like that when one hopes to survive.
No, Latimer, she's submitting herself to their judgment.
Mercy? From a cat? Ridiculous, Mum. See, they've started walking all over her. It will only be a matter of time before one sits on her head.
No, I'm sure she's about to do something to make everything all right. Any moment now.
There we are. Look, the black one has sat on her head.
Oh, this is awful. Perhaps you'd better pack up the tea things, Latimer, before the cats decide to come and judge us as well.
My thoughts exactly, Mum.
While Latimer clears up, I'd like to raise my teacup to Bill Dixon and Linda White, the newest members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order, go to www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy. Oh, look! Lucy's not dead. She's standing up.
That cat is still on her head.
Yes, she's wearing it like a crown. And look at the way the cats are parting ahead of her. It seems they judged her worthy. But worthy of what?
Oh, dear. I do believe that Miss Houndsome is now the queen of cats, and that they are now her cat army. I refer you to my earlier comment about the impending apocalypse.
It's not the apocalypse. It's a very nice thing.
For Miss Houndsome, perhaps. but I dread to think of what they'll do to her upholstery.
Time to go, Latimer. Find us a new tea lair, would you? Somewhere there are no cats.
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.